a one who visits you? To which he replied, my son. He who visits me during my life, or after my death, or visits your father, or your brother, or yourself, becomes deserving of my visiting him on the day of resurrection, when I will rid him of his sins. Right, so this, not only it does it legitimize the visitation of the graves of the Prophet and the, you know, the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, but it also explicitly says that this is a meritorious act which causes the person who performs it to deserve otherworldly a reward in the hereafter. In the of course, we would like to, by way of just to note here, when the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam says that I will rid him of his sins, he is referring to the sins, personal sins, which are not instances of the usurpation of the rights of other human beings. For that, a person is also required to ask the forgiveness of the person whose rights he has usurped. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the permissibility of visitation of the graves of Muslims in the light of the Hadith and the Quran. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key, an IRIB English radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to Islamic Upbringing on IRIB English Radio. I'm Zainab, your host, and I'm thrilled to be here. In this program, we'll be diving into the world of Islamic upbringing, exploring the challenges and triumphs of raising children in harmony with the principles of Islam. From answering your questions to discussing most important topics in parenting, our discussions will be grounded in the wisdom of Quran, Hadith, and the teachings of noble Imams. Today, we are joined by Brother Miqdad, who's a research scholar in the House of Ilmi of Qom. Let's welcome him. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah to you and to all the brothers and sisters who are listening.
Walaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for coming, and we are excited to be here with you today again to benefit from your valuable insights. So, you know, Brother Mikdad, there are teenagers, there are these young children who love to make friends, who love to be joined by friends, who love to be loved by friends, actually. So we would want you to discuss the topic of friendship with us today.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, when we discuss issues related to teenagehood, and as we want to call them, young adults as well, out of respect for this very important journey that these 11, 12, up until 17-year-olds go through. One of the discussions that comes at this age is the discussion on friendship, the discussion on social interactions with the same gender.
Right.
So we're talking about boys having friends amongst their boy circle and girls having friends amongst their sisters or girl sections, and having friends with their girls and sisters together. One of the things that we see, and those who have had any interaction with teenagers will realize that friendship at this age is very, very important. And they count it as amongst the most important things in their lives. Very difficult for them to detach from their friends. Very important for them to have acceptance from their friends, to be part of a group. They build their social identity based on their friendship. They're heavily influenced by their friends and also heavily influence their friends as well. And at times we've seen as well that this can be gone to extremes as well, where you have mental health issues that stem from an extreme level of friendship, which is not what we really want to see and is not correct. And so it's a very important discussion when it comes to friendship, the whole discussion of peer pressure over here, and generally the emotional attachment to another person that comes at this age is one that we need to discuss, we need to evaluate, and we need to use it. Because like any other traits that youth have and teenagers have at this age, the potential for it to be used in a positive way is very big.
Right.
But also at the same time, it also can lead to, you want to call it disasters, or you want to call it mistakes, or extremes that would be harmful for the growth of a teenager. And therefore, this important discussion needs to be looked at. It needs to be implemented as well. And more important is parents need to be equipped with skills on how to deal with this issue related to friendship of their teenagers.
Right. Let's take a short break and we'll be back in a while. Dear listeners, don't go anywhere.
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic upbringing, and we are discussing the most important topic among the youth, and that is friendship. Well, Brother Mikdad said friendship is important, and young adults do count it as important. They consider it very important to have acceptance from their friends. They build their social identity on the on the ideas of their friends. They are heavily influenced, and they heavily influence their friends. There's this emotional attachment which needs to be evaluated, and there can be extreme disasters as well. So we need to look on this topic. So far we discussed that, and the stage is again yours, Brother McDonald.
So one of the introductory points that I want to mention over here is how we deal with teenagers is very important. So take this example that, or this discussion that we're having right now on friendship, or any other discussion that we can have on dealing with teenagers. It has some important points that I'd like to mention before we enter the discussion.
Right.
The first one is that it's very important to realize that teenagehood is a period of life that many events happen in this period. And it's one that changes a person a lot. It's like a rough sea.
I don't know,
for those who've been on a sea in the ocean, for example, the waves can be very dangerous. But at the same time, we have to realize that whilst teenagers are going through all this, it's important that parents are equipped with the right skills to be able to navigate through this, to be able to overcome the waves and keep their control to navigate the sea despite the waves. And this is very important. I feel that many parents, although they have a lot of love for their children, they have sincere intentions, the reason why perhaps they fail or they lack a good relationship with their teenagers is because they don't know what teenagers are going through. They don't understand what teenagers are going through. Or they don't know the techniques of how to deal with teenagers. They don't understand the methodology of dealing with teenagers. And you find this all the time. So, for example, when you come to the discussion on seeking independence, you find that a child at this age, a teenager, wants to make a decision on buying a pair of clothes, for example. Right? And so imagine the scenario. He comes home and says, "Mom, I want some money. I want to go buy a pair of clothes with my friends." And mom says, "Your clothes are fine. If you need more clothes, your dad will come with you and you can buy with your dad."
Right.
The child gets really upset, slams the door, comes back the next day, and he's got a new pair of clothes on, or a new pair of trousers on. And mom asks, "Where did you get those trousers from?" Eh? Or he goes, "I bought them. I took some loan that I will pay back myself when I work. So you don't have to worry about it."
Yes.
You see, over here, the mother didn't know how to deal with this teenager that wanted a bit of
independence
in being able to make their own decision. And so their intention was very good, but they couldn't have this fruitful communication. And this is the third point I want to go to, is that many of these traits of teenagers, when faced with them, parents have to direct those energies, not confront it.
Right.
See, when it comes to teenagehood, we don't confront teenagers, right? When they want independency, when they want to do things their own way, when they want to make their own decision, when they want attention towards themselves, they want to dress in a particular way, put their hair in a particular way. It's important that we realize that this energy, we can't counter it. I'll come back to the example of the wave, right? Imagine when you're in the sea, you never try to go on the wave directly hitting the wave,
right?
You try to navigate over the wave in a way that you can go forward, whilst the wave is over there.
Safe. Right. We'll discuss more with you, Brother McDowell, after a short break. Dear listeners, don't go anywhere.
The Prophet ﷺ said, "Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing with Brother McDowell, discussing friendship in teenagers. Well, we said that dealing with teenagers is very important. Parents have to realize that teenagers are a period of many, many rough events, and it's parents should be equipped with the skills to navigate things correctly. Brother McDowell said it's very important to learn how to direct things rather than confronting them. So, yes, Brother McDowell.
So when we look at friendship, you realize that friendship is a need that children have at this age. If you remember our discussion previously on the needs of children, one of the needs that teenagers build, it's there previously as well, the social need in children is there. You find children even at the age of 5, 6, 7, 8, they want to play with their friends. They're having a lot of good time with their friends.
Right.
But over here, when we talk about teenagers, this attachment to friend changes. It's no more, I want to play with my friends. It builds a more emotional attachment.
Right.
You find six-year-olds, for example, they want to have a very good time with their friends and they will have loads of fun. But when they're away from their friends, I mean, the communication is not that much. I mean, how many six-year-olds, you know, want to stay in touch with their friends when they're at home, for example? Or how much conversation do they have about their private life, about how they feel? None of that. It's just we play together, we have a good football time together, or we play on the computer together, or we do some interaction together in terms of a project together or an activity together. But suddenly when you come to teenagers, friendship takes a new meaning now.
Yes.
Friendship is something that is a strong emotional attachment. They value this friendship for many different things. One is to be able to speak to them about their private matters, about how they feel. This is something that you wouldn't see in children before this. But yes. Teenagers now are willing to share things that they would not share with anyone. They share with their friends. And also things that they don't share with their parents, they would share with their friends.
Right.
Friendship is also it takes a dimension greater than just the period that they're together.
Right.
Even when they're not with their friends, they still try to stay in communication with them through the normal gadgets and the devices that we have and the communication methods of today.
Right.
But also in their mind, they're thinking about their friends. See, a six-year-old doesn't really care what his friend's going through when they're on holiday.
Yes.
Right. But a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old is thinking about what my friend is going through right now.
Right.
That attachment remains even in the absence of a friend. If that relationship is built, then the thinking and the stress and the attachment remains even when they're not together physically. And if it's not controlled, if it's not managed, if it's not directed in the right way, what happens is that this can lead to some issues, some problems, some difficulties later on, some extreme attachments that would derail the growth and the derbia of this teenager.
Right. So we said that friendship is a need and young children do feel this social need. They are emotionally attached than just playing with their friends. Friendship has a new meaning in their lives when they grow up and they have strong emotional attachments. And they speak more about their private matters and they prefer and they are comfortable with their friends. And if it's not controlled, it can lead to disasters. Until another episode, take good care of yourself. In case you want to listen to our previous episodes, go back to our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/en. There's a tab, Call of Islam, and there you can search our programs, Islamic Upbringing, and you can get back to the archive of our programs. Thank you so much for listening. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
Gaza under attack. Welcome back to Gaza under attack, a deep dive into the news surrounding the ongoing U.S.-Israeli genocidal war on Gaza and the brutal violence against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. I'll bring you my panel in a moment, but first a review of some of the latest developments. Unending Israeli attacks, frequent evacuation orders, and forced displacements have further devastated the battered health system in the besieged Gaza Strip. That, according to the UN's Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, also known as UNRWA. In Gaza's southern city of Khan Yunis, Israel has killed over 24 Palestinians, with reports of the regime's snipers targeting everyone across the city. armed by the United States. New revelations that Washington has provided the Israeli regime with over 25,000 bombs and missiles since October last year. Also in the U.S., Vice President and presidential candidate Kamala Harris says she will not be silent about the suffering in Gaza. The response from the Israeli regime, there will be no truce, Madam Candidate. In Europe, the U.K. drops its planned legal challenge against arrest warrants that the International Criminal Court is seeking for Israel's top leaders. Germany and some other European countries are yet to support the court's decision. And in the wake of a China-brokered national unity supported by Iran, will the rival Palestinian movements reconcile their differences and lobby for an end to Israel's occupation? 9 months of the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war on Gaza has killed at least 39,000 Palestinians and wounded more than 90,000 others. Helping me unpick all of that is Ali Azam, co-founder of the Virtue Ethics Foundation. And via Zoom, joining us all the way from Johannesburg, South Africa, is the spokesperson for Africa for Palestine, Tisetsu Magama. Gentlemen, thank you both for being here. Ali, if I may start with you, this decision by the UK government, we saw them flip-flop right after getting into parliament and into government. This, of course, started when the Conservatives under Sunak were in power. What is your reaction to this decision by the UK to drop its potential legal challenge to the ICC seeking those arrest warrants for Netanyahu and co?
I would say that we can only rely on the speculations at the moment. What are the motives? You know, what are these dropping objections based on? We don't know. There's been surprises from, obviously, Conservative were very open about their position, and Starmer obviously coming into fire with a lot of different issues surrounding. So I suppose that there is a caution on that side, but whether or not it yielded any genuine possibilities of support for Palestinians and from the fact that if the warrants are issued, contributes to something, it's a far-fetched thing to even, you know, contemplate or think of. So I think at the moment it is quite just speculations.
But again, do you think moving forward we'll see any change in the UK's foreign policy? Already we have seen, for example, Labour going from calling for a sustained period of calm, if I'm not mistaken, to calling for an immediate ceasefire under this government, David Lammy, the foreign secretary. But then again, a lot of criticism against him for having traveled to the occupied territories of 1948, shaking hands with the Israeli prime minister. But do you think we're on the cusp of a radical or significant change in UK foreign policy?
Personally, I think that I'm skeptical about the whole thing because their narratives do not match the actions or the policies. And if they were ever to move in that side, we can expect a lot of pressure, Israeli pressure, U.S. pressure, to, you know, reverse anything that if it goes in that direction. So I'm quite skeptical.
Okay, let's go to Johannesburg. And to set so, this whole attempt to block the ICC from issuing those arrest warrants is led, of course, by the United States. This week we saw the cheers in the U.S. Congress for Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister. But what I'd like to ask you is, what do you make of the Vice President Kamala Harris, who could potentially be the next U.S. president, saying the war in Gaza has to end?
No, look, it's clear, at least at this stage, that Kamala Harris is looking to wooing the support of a disenchanted and disillusioned younger voting population. And those on the center left and the left on the left spectrum. And so I do not, and I think we shouldn't read too much into it. We've seen, you know, the protests that have been, you know, breaking out throughout the U.S. For the past few months. And clearly there is a deep sense of being lost, you know, or at least of a certain portion of the voters being lost to the Democratic Party. And it seems that, you know, conversely, this has given Trump a second, boost towards the elections. And so at this stage, really, there is no substance other than the symbolic gesturing from the vice president, of course, with one eye on the election.
We'll talk about Trump later, but you know the words are important too. You hear things even in Kamala Harris's statements, the war in Gaza, not even the war on Gaza, or the plausible genocide, at least according to the ICJ, that's out there. No such comments from American leaders, making it into something that is an equal conflict or war between two equal sides, which, as we know, is not the case.
No, absolutely. Look, it's part of the rank hypocrisy of the United States. I'll tell you something. A few years ago, I had a very interesting, conversation with a senior U.S. diplomat, and I wanted to understand what animates U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, and especially insofar as Israel is concerned. And I got a very enlightening response. I was told in one line, for America, this is a domestic issue. Mm-hmm. So the point here is that the question of Israel for Americans is as much an issue about healthcare, about unemployment or employment and the economy and so on. It's deeply ingrained in the American body politic. And so if you understand and appreciate that reality about Israel, mm-hmm. you will then understand why American leadership from both parties, will throw overboard even their own laws, such as the laws that regulates the transfer of weapons to conflict zones, which strictly prohibits the United States government from transferring those weapons to Israel. Yet they have found ways of continuing to do that. And so what I'm saying to you is that I think in the final analysis, if we appreciate the fact that for America, Israel is a domestic issue, we will understand why then it's easy for them, to get rid of any inhibitions they may have insofar as that is concerned.
Mm-hmm. All right. Meantime, displaced Palestinians in central Gaza have reacted with anger and surprise at Netanyahu's speech to the U.S. Congress. Instead of any overtures towards a ceasefire, more bloodshed was touted. Let's hear a little of what people said in Gaza.
He did not mention ceasefire or anything. He wants to continue with what he's doing to kill and destroy the Palestinian people. He wants to wipe out resistance, but he cannot do that, so he's wiping out the Palestinian people.
I was surprised. Netanyahu has not changed since two decades. He is a vampire who kills children and women. We were expecting Netanyahu to declare a truce, a ceasefire in the American Congress. The Congress applauded him, which means that Netanyahu is ruling the world. This is what I see. The world is not ruling Israel, but Israel is ruling the world.
All right, Ali, you heard the word ceasefire several times in those two soundbites, residents in the enclave. What is standing in the way of a ceasefire from taking hold or being agreed upon at this point, in your opinion?
Moment, I think in the last 9 or 10 months, you've seen that America has a certain position. So has the West, UK, Germany, and I don't think that there is any there can be any flexibility for that to move. So even these empty talks, empty narratives of ceasefire, even when they come, they bear no value, no power, no force. Mm-hmm. I think they're just a bit of smoke screens behind which everything is exactly the same, but they need to kind of, delusionize people, delusionize the social kind of a political imagination and consensus of that. So I think ceasefire is far from Netanyahu's own personal agendas and interest. I don't think
he himself, of course, is one big obstacle to it.
Sorry,
Netanyahu himself is an obstacle too. a truce.
We could argue that it's not just Netanyahu. I think the fact that majority in Israel's are continuing to be pro-war, it just kind of illustrates where the psyche is at the moment in terms of what, you know, is it genocide, is it war, is it war which is justifiable. Even now when you hear most of presenters on the radio and other political analysts, I think there is quite an openness about questioning still the nature of the war, whether it's genocide or it's just war. It happens in war. So still, I think majority is thinking within those frameworks that it's just a war and we have to accomplish certain goals and objectives, and that's for the interest of the Israelis' well-being. So I think unless that is broken, fractured, I don't think that we are going anywhere near it.
Okay. Tesetsu, I'm sure you listened to watch the speech by Netanyahu at the U.S. Congress. He was almost obsessed with the Islamic Republic of Iran in his speech. He named Iran 10 times, I guess. And that is who he really wants a direct confrontation with. Is that right?
Yes and no. Yes, he wants a direct confrontation with Iran, but not with the Israeli military. What he's looking for is essentially to draft the U.S. military into a war with Iran. You see, that will do two things for Netanyahu and his ilk. The one is they hope to forever bury, obliterate the Palestinian question on the one hand. But the second leg of this strategy of a confrontation with Iran will also then, essentially they hope destroy Israel's nemesis in the region. Because if you look at the geopolitical picture within the Middle East, Western powers, and in particular the United States, is essentially on the cusp of achieving what they've always set out to achieve, which was to elevate Israel as a regional power in West Asia. Mm-hmm. That, of course, will serve U.S. geostrategic interests. And so what has emerged over the years, of course, is two things. One is the Arab and Muslim governments in the Middle East, of course, have been brought to heel. They can be managed. And we've seen that with the Abraham Accords on the one hand.
Right.
The stubborn problem that simply refuses to go away is the Islamic Republic. And so if they are able then to do that and get the American military to obliterate the Islamic Republic, Israel will of course emerge as the winner, and hopefully I think establish itself as a regional hegemon. I think that is really the geopolitical strategy that we are seeing. And the problem, though, for Netanyahu is neither the West, the collective West, and in particular the United States, is particularly enthusiastic about getting into a direct confrontation with the Islamic Republic.
And, of course, another argument is that Netanyahu and his gang have lost the war, so-called, in the Gaza Strip, and that Iran is not at war, and its aligned groups in the region, the Ansarullah in Yemen, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and others, are keeping Israel in check. Now, the U.S.-led war on Gaza is likely to get much worse if white supremacist Donald Trump is elected as the U.S. president later this year. But would a black woman, Kamala Harris, be any better? We asked an economic and political activist based in New York for his analysis.
Well, she's been extremely rabid, foaming at the mouth, zealot Zionist. At least this is the way she's been projecting herself when she was the district attorney of California and later becoming a senator. You know, I remember she was selected during a Wall Street fundraiser to be the vice president. Nobody wanted her. Not even in her own state she wanted to vote. That's how horrible she is. Kamala Harris is basically what they would call here white supremacy in blackface. Like the same policies you know, the same imperialism, anti-poor, anti-worker, anti-Arab, anti-black. You know, they just get a black person to do it. So she'll be a continuing, she'll be another link in the chain of imperialism. There's not going to be any change. It might get worse, if that's even possible.
We also asked Erebus Abzulamashtu what the way forward for America is and if there ever will be change for the better.
Well, Zionism is an ideology. And like any ideology, it has an emotional sort of religious connection to it. It's very emotional. And, you know, I like to say that in America, we live in a country of 100 million activists, but nobody wants to take power. And without power, change is not possible. Like, for instance, I'm part of whatever's left of the People's Party, and we chose last year, back in June, we selected Cornel West to be the president. And within, in less than a week, right, he ran off to another party who's focusing on identity and not working class issues and not trying to end wars. So we have a problem of people who want to be on YouTube and do live streams and do all this stuff and yell in the streets. And those things are tools and they're useful. But we don't have a George Galloway, for instance. We don't have a Workers' Party here. And, you know, until people get serious and take power and sit there at the table where they can determine the policies, we're not going to get anywhere here. Right? And they know that. We have a situation where the majority of the population is focused on identity to the exclusion of everything else. It's all identity politics and culture wars, which cannot be won. So Zionism here is just another identity, another culture war. So until we get serious people to come in and take power and fight the establishment from without and from within, you know, the apparatus, you know, I don't see any prospects here of things changing. I mean, Jackson Hinkle started a communist party with Haz al-Din. Hopefully it gets somewhere. But other than that, I don't think it's going to improve at all.
At the third Genocide in Gaza symposium hosted by the Bristol Palestine Alliance, we caught up with one of the speakers, Professor David Miller. We asked for his reaction to the ICJ ruling that the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands is illegal, if the ruling held any weight, and what the likely next step was.
Yes, it's a legal ruling, and of course the problem, as you say in your question, is whether anyone's going to pay any attention to it. And it looks like people aren't going to pay attention to it. Of course, it's been rejected by the Israelis and by other governments. But look, the point here is that this is a step-by-step process which marginalizes and puts into a corner the Zionists and all of their supporters. Step by step, we put them more and more into a corner which they can't get out of. And so, it's obviously it's welcome in that respect because it helps other people to say, well, actually, there's a clear ruling here in terms of international law. What does it say about David Lammy, the Foreign Secretary of the UK, who went and shook hands with Netanyahu in advance of this happening, who has previously said that he's in favour of international law? Well, it puts him in a very difficult position. And that's the kind of incremental way in which this will hype up the pressure on the governments, the states who are supporting the genocide. But at a wider level, of course, it's quite small as a step forward. It is a step forward, but we're also facing a multitude of other steps forward. Obviously, there is global public opinion, but the attempt by the Zionists to escalate in both Lebanon and in Yemen is an attempt which will certainly bring escalation. The Ansarullah and indeed Hezbollah have said that they will significantly respond to these provocations and further steps up what they call the escalation ladder. And of course, this is a desperate situation for the Zionists. They're playing really their last card because what they want is to bring the US in on their side. But the US is reluctant and will be reluctant because, of course, the US knows that it can't easily triumph in such a conflict because they know perfectly well that Ansarullah and indeed Hezbollah have weaponry which can sink U.S. aircraft carriers. And that's why, of course, they've withdrawn one of their aircraft carriers, which was damaged by missiles, which they pretended was just due to come to the end of its 90-day mission. It hadn't even been there 90 days. So there's a real difficulty for the U.S. because these are much vaunted projections of U.S. power, the aircraft carriers and the associated warboats. They're essentially been transformed by the weaponry which Hezbollah and Ansar Allah have into floating metal targets in the sea.
Professor David Miller speaking there. Well, we have just a few moments left to the end of the show. Let's get a couple of questions in there. And if I may, I will start with Tetsetsu. South Africa called on the ICJ back in May to order Israel to end the Rafah offensive. That never happened. Should we be optimistic about any new diktats from the International Court of Justice?
No, certainly not. These institutions have shown themselves to be impotent. You know, they have no impact whatsoever because you see what you see in international relations, especially in the you know, global governance institutions, is that it is typically only the West that will put their resources behind the enforcement of certain decisions, whether it's the UN Security Council or even the WTO and other institutions. And so you have that dynamic that is there within these global governance institutions. But I think for us, at the end of the day, in spite of the lack of action or the impotence of these institutions, the struggle continues. But I think there should be one fundamental shift in our focus of struggle, which is we have to focus not only on Israel as an occupier, as an apartheid state, but we should also equally focus our energies on the United States, without which or without whom we know Israel's genocide, for instance, now, would never have taken place and would never have persisted for this long. And so whether it's a Kamala Harris or a Donald Trump that emerges, to us as activists, and certainly for the Palestinian people, their fundamental grievances remain, and the struggle must continue. But then we have to adjust.
Yeah, let me pick up on that and put a question to Ali, and that is, you heard the analysis there from Johannesburg and, of course, from New York. Do you think Donald Trump is the guy that the Israelis under this government are looking for as president of the U.S.?
Yes, quite now a popular consensus on that Netanyahu is actually waiting for Donald Trump to, you know, get into the government so that they can have a complete, you know, free pass to just do
carte blanche.
Carte blanche to continue. Even if Donald Trump is not elected, even with Kamala Harris, we can see that, you know, there's the kind of a narrative is there which shows sympathy for the people in Gaza and Palestinians, but there is nothing that is, you know, one can kind of infer that from their policies or their actions anything can ever be in support of Palestinians. So, you know, it's just a different kind of an expressions of Americans' position, but the position nevertheless never changed and will not change.
Will not change. All right, we're going to have to leave it there, gentlemen. That is all for this Gaza Under Attack. Special thanks to Ali Azam and Tetsetsu Magama, and of course to you. Till we meet again, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Darsi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll discuss some of the contents of chapter Naml, the 27th chapter of the Holy Quran, as well as some of the commentary points of the verses. Dear listeners, as you were with us, we have reached the 60th verse of chapter Naml. Now let's listen to this verse.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
أَمَّنْ خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ وَأَنزَلَ لَكُم مِّنَ السَّمَاءِ مَاءً فَأَنبَتْنَا بِهِ حَدَائِقَ ذَاتَ بَهْجَةٍ مَا كَانَ لَكُمْ أَن تُنبِتُوا شَجَرَهَا أَإِلَٰهٌ مَّعَ اللَّهِ بَلْ هُمْ قَوْمٌ يَعْدِلُونَ.
More precisely, is he not best who created the heavens and the earth and sent down for you rain from the sky, causing to grow thereby gardens of joyful beauty, which you could not otherwise have grown the trees thereof? Is there a deity with Allah? No, but they are a people who ascribe equals to him.
So in this verse, the Almighty Allah, in continuation of the previous verse, that discussed the very important fact that is Allah better or what they associate with him, continues, or he who caused and created the heavens and the earth? Whom? Which one do you think is better? أَمَّنْ خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ وَأَنزَلَ لَكُم مِّنَ السَّمَاءِ مَاءً. Is this God better or the ones that you associate with him? أَمَّنْ خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ وَأَنزَلَ لَكُم مِّنَ السَّمَاءِ مَاءً فَأَنبَتْنَا بِهِ حَدَائِقَ ذَاتَ بَهْجَةٍ. So, is this God better or he who created the heavens and the earth? He sent down for you water from the sky. Then we caused to grow thereby beautiful gardens. مَا كَانَ لَكُمْ أَن تُنْبِتُوا شَجَرَهَا. And it was not in your power to grow the trees from it. أَإِلَهٌ مَّعَ اللَّهِ. Is there any God with Allah? بَلْ هُمْ قَوْمٌ يَعْدِلُونَ. No, they are a people who deviate. So as we said, all we understand, the main point of this verse is that contemplation over the creation of the Almighty Allah always helps us recognize that there is one absolute cause in this universe. Now, after we discussed some of the terms and terminologies used in the beginning part of the verse in the previous episode, we refer to the next part of this verse. At the end of the verse, the Holy Quran addresses the servants of the Almighty Allah and says, it was not in your power that you grew the trees thereof. مَا كَانَ لَكُمْ أَن تُنْبِتُوا شَجَرَهَا. So, what you servants of the Almighty Allah can do is that you should only sow the seed and irrigate it. But he, subhanahu wa ta'ala, is the one who created the life inside this seed. He is the one who commands the sunlight, the life-giving drops of rain, and the pieces of soil to grow this seed. And this is only in the power of the Almighty Allah. Now, there are some facts that none can deny or attribute them to other than Allah. Is he who is the creator of the heavens and the earth, and is the sender of rain more powerful, or the ones that you associate with him? He is the cause of all the beauties and favors in this world. This is the kind of God.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Dear listeners, paying attention to the different nuances and details of the parts of the creation can really help us. As we said, the main point and theme of this verse is that contemplation over different parts of the creation of this universe can help us reach our destination in our path of finding the Almighty Allah. Even paying attention to the coloring of a flower, the delicate and regular arrangement of the leaves inside each other that have circulated around the central point of the flower, and the cry of existence of life. These are enough to acquaint man with the glory, with the power, with the knowledge of the Almighty Allah. These are the facts which move the man's heart, and they actually call him towards him. In other words, unity in creation, I mean the unity of creator, and unity in lordship, the unity of the divisor of this world, are counted as the basis of the unity of the object of worship. So by contemplation over what you see in this world, over what is created, and by contemplation over how they were created and whether they are left alone or not, we can reach the unity of the Almighty Allah. So at the end of the verse, the Holy Quran says, is there any God with Allah? أَإِلَهُمْ مَّا اللَّهِ بَلْ هُمْ قَوْمٌ يَعْدِلُونَ. But they are a people who deviate. So unity is the straight path, and deviation is nothing but believing in Almighty Allah as well as some other gods. This is deviation, as this verse mentions. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of RIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Amin Rastani.
The calamities that befall us, that we don't like, that we run away from, that we, if we embrace them for whatever they are and accept that this is a reality of life, have the potential to raise us to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. In addition to, of course, the deficient worship that we have. We weren't trying to hate on worship, by the way. Let me just say this. The worship still has to be there in its deficiency. Because I'm telling Allah, oh Allah, although I know my worship is deficient, I'm still doing it because I know this is what you want from me. So let's keep that in mind as well. Okay, so that makes up for the deficiency of our worship. So worship plus all the other stuff that we go through in this life. But if that has the potential to elevate us, the bala of the awliyaullah, the difference between that and the bala that we go through is that my bala is going to personally elevate me, while they say that the one who is one of awliyaullah and goes through their pain and suffering, their bala, it will not just elevate them, it elevates an ummah with them. Okay? And yes, because it's supposed to elevate an ummah with them, it's not going to be your normal everyday standard bala and hardship necessarily. It's not going to be something that is expected for normal people to endure. I'll give you an example. Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam, we have a hadith in Usul al-Kafi that the sixth imam, he said, that a person who is free is always free. Inna al-hur hurrun ala jami'i ahwalihi. A free person is always going to be free. Not just in certain situations. Not in certain situations that we flex and we say, ah, I have tawakkul, I have Allah, I'm a free person, this and that. No, in all situations, even when the going gets rough. And so it goes on the hadith. I'm going to reach to the part that I need here, where it says that Yusuf was ustu'bida, he was taken as a slave. And he was, they had dominion over him and power over him. He was a nobody. And he was taken prisoner and captivated. But the darkness of the well, it didn't affect him. The horror and fright that he had of the darkness of the well didn't get to him. He endured, he was patient. To the extent that Allah, mannallahu alayhi, Allah did minnat on him, favored him. And so he made the one that was on top of him, the ruler that was over him, all of a sudden subordinate to him. We all know the story because there's a movie on it. بَعْدَ إِذْ كَانَ لَهُ مَالِكًا فَأَرْسَلَهُ وَرَحِمَ بِهِ أُمَّةً. Yusuf passed all those tests. As a result, guess what Allah did? رَحِمَ اللَّهُ بِهِ أُمَّةً. Allah showed mercy and grace to an ummah because of Yusuf. The barakah of such an individual and the bala that they go through is that an ummah is helped because of them. The people of Egypt were saved. Yusuf's brothers were saved. His family was brought to Egypt. His father was cured, etc., etc. So everything because one person was a proper abd of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And then here I am thinking, when I do something wrong, when I do something haram, oh, it's just me, whatever. No. These sins that we commit, they have an effect on the natural world, whether we like it or not. The secular people, they'll laugh at us. But that's what our sources are telling us. So which this all brings me now to the calamity of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Yeah. If Yusuf, the people of his time, yeah, they were marhum and were subject to the rahmah of Allah as a result of his patience, then Imam Hussein alayhi salam, you know, it goes without mentioning that his bala, because it's the highest of all balas, that other prophets of God, according to our hadiths, when they heard his story, they couldn't stop but weeping and couldn't eat for God knows how long. When his musibah happens, it's not just one ummah of one time that is going to be saved and secured. But guess what? Everybody who somehow